Good morning. My name is Jay Rhodes. I'm the integrating pastor here. That's just a fancy title for executive pastor of ministries. I lead staff. Pastors are to minister to people. Turns out that staff are people too. So it's like herding cats, and I love every moment of it. Eric assigned me this passage, and I'm going to get him when he gets back. 1 Samuel 25. He cited that to me, and I was like, I don't remember anything in there. So I went and read it, and then I looked up a journal article. The very first passage I read in a commentary on this passage was this. What a dark chapter to study. One evil man's influence casts clouds over the entire narrative and causes the man after God's own heart to seek revenge, an emotion that is opposite God. One small drop of evil can ruin much good. May we walk away from this chapter convinced of the tragedy of living our earthly lives as a fool. Remember Nabal, a son of Satan. Do not emulate his folly. Pretty exciting stuff. So let's get right into it. Now Samuel died. That's the first sentence. And it's downhill from here. Okay, Samuel died. Biblical scholars say that Samuel was about 52 whenever he died. Biblical theologians disagree, and they say he's 98. But regardless, doesn't matter. We'll take it both ways, because I don't know what's right. And the Bible really doesn't say how old he was. They just said very, very, very old. If Samuel was 52, he died at 52. He had already passed the baton to the next generation. He already passed the baton to David, who was in his 20s. Now, some of us in the room are older than 52. We are totally, completely behind schedule in passing the baton to the next generation. Now, let's say Samuel was 98. That doesn't mean he was passing the baton to the next generation. He was passing the baton not even to the next generation, not even the next generation, but the next generation. He was reaching deep, and he was passing the baton to some very young and reckless, unfocused, immature, totally, completely unqualified, and totally over their head leadership styles. What's interesting about this passage is now Samuel died, and all of Israel assembled and mourned for him, and they buried him in the house of Ramah, and David rose and went to the wilderness of Paran. There's several things that are interesting about this. One, now Samuel died, so Samuel died, David rose. So you see a transition of some bit large magnitude here. It's also funny that all of Israel assembled and mourned for Samuel. If you look at 1 Samuel 8, 1 through 7, they didn't like Samuel. They didn't like his sons. They didn't like his ideas. This whole idea of a theocracy was crazy. Hey, we want you to, you're all messed up. We want you to appoint a king. And he's like, okay, I'll appoint a king. Not that one, he's just 20. We want a king like all the other countries. So they kind of hammered him pretty bad. But as soon as he died, everybody's mourning for him. You know, a lot of us are that way, you know, in our heart of hearts. Don't really appreciate the people right in front of us. But as soon as they're gone, we miss them. It's sad. So David rose, went down to the wilderness of Paran, which was by Maon and by Carmel. It's about 25 miles south of Jerusalem and about 25 miles east of the Dead Sea. And it was the wilderness. If you go there today in modern Israel, it's still desolate. I mean, no one really wants to live there. So there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel. The man was very rich. You know, we have to ask, you know, what does it mean to be rich? There are people who are rich with stuff. And then there's people that are rich with the ability to do things. And there's other people who are rich with the knowledge of special things. And then there's people rich in character. But the Bible makes it clear. The man was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep and 3,000 goats. That's a lot of sheep and goats. At our max, Paul and I had 100 chickens, 9 turkeys, 8 rabbits, maybe 40 or 50 fish. And I'm telling you, that's very labor intensive. And those are all single and double digits. But this guy was pushing on thousands of sheep, thousands of goat. And he was shearing his sheep in Carmel. What's funny is people that don't believe the Bible, you know, they all of a sudden they become literalists when it comes to verses like this. They're like, how can one guy, like, do all those sheep? And to interpret the Bible literally means to interpret it as literature. I don't know. I'm just confessing. I just don't. I just don't like doing it. I have a spiritual gift. I have 2 sons. So whenever Paula asks me to mow the yard, I'm like, no problem, baby. I got this. Hey, Wes. Hey, Daniel. Can you mow the yard? Okay. I mowed the yard because I told them to do it. I supervised the whole situation, and it was mowed right. Same deal here. Just imagine how much manpower this guy had. Not only did he have wealth, but he had the horsepower and the manpower behind it to even take care of all that. He had servants. His servants had servants. Those servants probably even had servants. This guy was rich. Now the name of the man was Nabal. And the name of his wife was Abigail. The woman was discerning and beautiful. I know it's politically incorrect to say a woman is beautiful today, but we're going to go with it. It's in the Word of God. We have to cover it. But she wasn't a trophy wife, right? She was discerning. Some translations say intelligent. Well, you know, evil people can be intelligent. I really don't like the word discerning, too, because discerning carries a meaning of being judgmental. Other translations translates it sensible. It's probably a more apt description. She was sensible. She brought reason to things. She brought out the truth of things in a very helpful, compassionate manner. A word about discerning. I know there's some super spiritual people here, and I'm just going to address them for a second. If you're a super spiritual person, and you go to websites, discernment websites, to help you discern about this pastor or this preacher or this commentary and that commentary, and the website just shreds that other Christian because he used the wrong word one time in some place, some other way, stop. That's not discernment. It isn't. It's judgmentalism. Disguised as discernment. Discernment is sensible. Carries Christian virtues of compassion and grace and reads what the person meant, not what the person said. The woman was discerning and beautiful, but the man was harsh and badly behaved. He was a Calebite. So the man was harsh and badly behaved. I mean, those are pretty obvious terms. But here's the kicker. He was a Calebite. Caleb was a very, very spiritual guy. And this guy was a descendant of him. If you're a parent and you have children that are dreadfully wayward, have you ever considered that it might not be your fault? Have you ever considered that you might not have to go home every single night and beat yourself up because your kids are messed up? Nabal was harsh and badly behaved because Nabal chose to be that way. Caleb really doesn't have anything to do with it. Kids make their own choices. So if you're a parent that's beating yourself up, please, show yourself grace. Now, it's funny phrase, this Calebite. It's only used in the word once. However, it's like ice cream. Okay, ice cream. Is it ice cream or is it ice cream? You know, it depends on where you put the accent, right? Same words, same letters, you know, but they mean drastically two different things. Ice cream is one thing. Ice cream is what I do at horror movies. Calebite is the exact same kind of thing. It can mean Calebite, as in someone from the house of David, but it can also mean doggish. Doggish man. And what's interesting is the Syriac text, the Arabic text, and the Greek translation of the Hebrew doesn't see this as Calebite at all. They see it as doggish man. And I think there's some merit to that, because it kind of flows better, but the man was harsh, badly behaved. He was doggish. This guy was a jerk, full throttle jerk. Makes you wonder why Abigail even married this guy. You know, probably an arranged marriage. Probably the parents had well-intentioned, right? Hey, you know what, this Nabal guy, you know, he's kind of a jerk. But he has a lot of money, you know, we at least know her. Our daughter will never starve to death. She'll have servants, she'll have a good life, she'll have educational opportunities, she'll have room for advancement, and probably arranged a marriage with this very rich, unbehaved Calebite. Now, David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep. So David sent 10 young men, and David said to the young men, "Go to Carmel and go to Nabal and greet him in my name." Okay, whenever you're shearing sheep, or even if you watch shows on TV like the Edwardian time period or the colonial time period, you'll notice that even all of those time periods in the West, whenever it came to sheep shearing time, it was a festival. It was a time for generosity. David knew, look, we're in the middle of nowhere. I mean, Nabal doesn't have anyone to be generous to. So we might as well introduce ourselves to him to give him the blessing of being generous and to give us the blessing of being generous too. So he sent guys to greet him and said, "Hey, man, we're here." David said, "Thus, you shall greet him. Peace be to you. Peace be to your house. Peace be to all that you have." This wasn't embezzlement. It wasn't like David was like saying, "Hey, give me money." You know, I mean, it was just a festival time. It's an opportunity. An opportunity to be gracious and kind to one another. "I hear that you have shears. Now your shepherds have been with us, and we did them no harm, and they missed nothing all the time they were here in Carmel. Ask your young men, and they will tell you. Therefore, let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we come on feast day. Please give whatever you have at hand to your servants and to your son David." It wasn't a fixed fee contract. It wasn't like, "Hey, we're protecting you, embezzlement," like New York, New Jersey style mob activity. It was just an opportunity of feast. People who are rich need opportunities to give, because giving is the antidote to materialism. When David's men came, they said all this to Nabal in the name of David. And then they waited. And Nabal answered David's servants, "Who is this David? Who is the son of Jesse? There are servants these days who are breaking away from their masters. Shall I take my bread, my water, my meat that I have killed for these shearers and give it to men who come from where I do not know where?" Now, a lot of commentaries, by the way, if you really like commentaries, don't. Read the Bible, not the commentary. I mean, seriously, the Bible's so much better than any commentary. Commentary is just someone's opinion. So a lot of commentaries focus on this, my bread, my water, my meat, and focus on the materialism component. But it calls Nabal a fool. Have you ever heard the statement, there's no such thing as a stupid question? Okay, I've taught at Trine University. I've taught at Tri-State University. I teach part-time at Texas A&M. And I will tell you that there are such things as stupid questions. In fact, there are whole categories of stupid questions. Seven, actually. Let's review. Using a question to make a statement. Are you that dumb? That's a foolish question. Question uses a trap. Lawyers do this all the time. So, whenever that guy came in out of the rain, he had an umbrella in his left hand. What color was the umbrella? And the lawyer knows the guy didn't have an umbrella in his hand. But the person on the witness stand feels like they need to be helpful. So they imagine a color. Not lying. It's just something the human brain tricks you. So, yeah, the black umbrella. And then the lawyer just walks him out with specific questions and then chops off the branch. That is great for a case. It is not a good approach to manage relationships on this earth. If you don't find yourself in a court of law, don't be a fool. Don't use a question as a trap. To the benefit of someone else. That's weird. I don't see how that could be foolish. Okay, you'd be shocked. People email me theological questions. And sometimes I will have two people in a theological debate. And one of them will send a question to me, hey, what do you think this Greek word means? Knowing that I'm going to answer in the way that they like to prove the person that CC'd wrong in their argument. He's not asking for his benefit. He's not asking me for his benefits. He's asking me because he's trying to triangulate me in a third-party argument. That's a stupid question. Asking a question that you could easily look up. A question directed at the wrong person. Hey, Josh, why do you think Eric did? You know how it goes? In your small group? You know, hey, why do you think on Sunday morning they did? Well, how about you ask Eric? How about you ask the people who organize the Sunday morning? Because asking a question to the wrong person is a foolish question. Asking a question that you already know the answer to. Asking a question to gossip. This is my all-time favorite. Hey, Pastor so-and-so hasn't been in the office this week. Do you think he's having marriage trouble? And then that plants that person's mind that they're having marriage trouble. And of course, they go and spread the rumor. Then we track it back to that person, you know, and it's like, well, you told him that, oh, I didn't say that he had marriage trouble. I just asked a question. It's just an unsavory way of gossip. You know, so whole categories of stupid questions. And Nabal asked a lot of stupid questions. Do you think he didn't know who David was? Really? Really? His wife knew who he was. So, David's young men turned away and came back and told him all of this. And David said to his men, every man strap on his sword. I'm like, whoa, a little bit of overreaction, a little bit homicidal maniac. I mean, he wasn't saying, I'm going to kill him, I'm going to mutilate him like he's on the Three Stooges or anything like that. I mean, he's dead serious. Dead literally serious. I mean, he was going to kill these guys. What does anger look like in your life? Might not look like a homicidal maniac, I hope. But what does it look like? Does it look like gasoline poured on a fire? Is it a smoldering fire that just burns everybody's eyes around? Is it underneath the ground, like a burning mine? Or is it like Yellowstone State Park that's just sitting there, waiting to explode and taking half of the country with it? A lot of us struggle with anger. No one has ever been elevated by responding to anger with anger. Never. Anger does not elevate. Anger causes us to sink low, sink to another level. David knew this. You can write this down in your margins. Psalm 37, verse 8. King David, later, says, don't be angry. It only leads to evil. Don't do it. So every man strapped on his sword. David strapped on his sword, and about 400 men went after David, while 200 remained with the baggage or with their supplies. That's why I say it wasn't embezzlement. Some commentaries say that he was like hard up for supplies, and therefore he was justified by asking. He's not hard up for supplies. Do you realize how much supplies you have to have 200 guys watch it? I mean, that's a lot of stuff. He wasn't short supply. He had plenty of supplies and plenty of anger. But one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's men, told Abigail, Nabal's wife, behold, David sent messengers out in the wilderness to greet our master, and he railed at them. Yet the men were very good to us, and we suffered no harm, and we didn't miss anything while they were in the fields, as long as we went with them. They were a wall to us, both by night and by day. All the while they were with them, keeping the sheep. Now, therefore, know this and consider what you should do. For harm is determined against our master and against all his house. He is such a worthless man that one cannot speak to him. That's a sad situation right there. Do you have a boss that you can't speak to? Do you have a boss that's a fool? I mean, why would you work for a guy like that? But they did. But they understood the insult. They understood the insult of not honoring the traditions of extending graciousness and extending generosity during a feast. Even Nabal's men understood that this was going to be serious issues, because this was an offense of offenses from a worthless man. Then Abigail made haste and took 200 loaves, 2 skins of wine, 5 sheep already prepared, 35 quarts of parched grain, and hundreds of clusters of raisins, and 200 cakes of figs, and laid them on donkeys. And she said to her young men, go before me, behold, I come after you. But she did not tell her husband Nabal. And she rode in the donkey and came under cover of the mountains. I'll tell you what. Come to my house, take 2 loaves of bread. I'm going to notice like that. I mean, but this guy, how much stuff did this guy have? I mean, 200 loaves of bread, 2 skins of wine, 5 sheep, 35 quarts of this, 200 of that. This was a rounding error to him. This stuff was gone and he didn't even notice. I mean, how much stuff did this guy have? He was totally in a position to be generous. But he wasn't. Behold, David and his men came towards her, and she met them. Now, David had just said, this is a good leadership 101 right here, complain to your men. Okay? David had just said, surely in vain I have guarded all that this fellow in the wilderness, so that nothing was missing of all that he belonged to him, and he has returned me evil for good. God do the same to the enemies of David and more also, if by morning I leave so much as one male of all who belong to him. That's craziness, isn't it? Let's look at this last verse. Because this last verse, really in the Hebrew, it's really, really super spiritual language that he's using. It's almost like an oath, the pledge, a promise that... So, however, because of all that super spiritual language, it's really hard to interpret. So the ESV interprets it this way, and we just read it. God do so to the enemies of David, and more so. So, if by morning I leave as much as one male of all of them who belong to him. So, if I don't kill all of them, and some guys escape and some guys are out and about, and I miss some, I want you to do to them what I did to them, but not just kill them. I want you to do more than that to them. You see what he's saying there? Second way, Holman Christian Standard Bible interprets it this way. May God punish me, David, and do so severely if I let any of his men survive till morning. It's a promise. I am promising to God. Pinky swear. Cross my heart. Hope to die. Stick a needle in my eye. That I'm going to kill every single one of these guys. And if I don't, God has permission to kill me and even do worse stuff to me than kill them if I don't fulfill this promise. The King James, super spiritual sounding translation, of course. So, and more, also do God unto the enemies of David. If I leave of all that pertain to him, by the morning light, any that pitheth against the wall. Is there any word that sticks out there to you? That's right, wall. Remember, I told you to remember the word wall earlier, right? That's the word that sticks out. Okay, because David's people were a wall to this guy. And what's funny is, wall's actually in the Hebrew for this verse. It just goes untranslated in the ESV or Christian Standard Bible. And so basically, David was his wall, and he was ticked off because they rejected his offer and figuratively peed on them. And it's also in verse 34. And show you that I'm not making this up. Peed on is actually in the original Hebrew. You know, my dad, whenever I was young, he'd be like, he could call me pisser for some reason. I don't know why, but he'd be like, hey, you little pisser, come here. And now I know. My dad was part Hebrew. Because to urinate is a pejorative, figurative meaning for man. Surely men have been called worse things, you know, but whoever says the Bible isn't interesting just isn't reading. I mean, seriously, this is good stuff. I mean, crazy stuff. So back to this. So given these three drastically different interpretations, I'm going to go with the middle one. Because both the Latin and the Greek does not translate God do so to the enemies of David, but actually translate make God hostile to David, not of David. So David's pledge was a pledge or a promise to make God hostile to David if he doesn't kill all of these people. That puts him in a dilemma. Either he is a oath violator and violates his oath, or he becomes a homicidal maniac. Those aren't two good options. I mean, Leadership 101 tells you don't paint yourself into a corner. Keep in mind, he's in his 20s. He's unqualified. Inexperienced. But God makes him qualified to have the Davidic covenant and bring in the theocracy in which Jesus came. Crazy, amazing stuff. So it reads like this. Surely in vain I have guarded all that this fellow has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed from all that belonged to him, and he has returned me evil for good. May God punish me and do so severely if I let any of his men survive till morning. Crazy stuff. And we look at that and that is kind of crazy. Really? How many times have you promised God that you'd do something and then don't? Right? Hey, January 1st, I'm going to lose 10 pounds. I promise God, if I don't lose 10 pounds, you know, oops, I gained 15. You know, I promise this year I'm going to read the Bible. You know, I'm going to get the one-year Bible, and I'm going to read it, and I'm going to have a bookmark, and I'm going to, February, I'm not reading the Bible. And then you feel so guilty about it, you can't even pick up the Bible again. The rest of that year, I guess next year we'll try again. Because you just beat yourself up because you made a vow and were unable to fulfill it. We do crazy things to ourselves. Maybe David isn't as crazy after all. Maybe he's just like us. He just uses slightly different means. When Abigail saw David, she hurried, got down from the donkey, and fell before David on her face and bowed to the ground. She fell at his feet and said, keep in mind, he was just saying, I'm going to kill all these guys. And she says this, on me alone, my Lord, be the guilt. If you're going to kill anyone, kill me. Let your servant speak to your ears and hear the words of your servant. Let not my Lord regard this worthless fellow in a ball. For as his name is, so is he. And Nabal means fool. How he got that name, I don't know, but he really truly lived up to it. And folly was with him. She continues, but I, your servant, did not see the young men of my Lord, David, whom you sent. Now then, my Lord, David, as the Lord lives, and as your soul lives, because the Lord has restrained you from blood guilt and from restrained you from saving with your own hand, now let your enemies and those who seek to do evil to my Lord be as Nabal, be as fools. And now let this present, this stuff that your servant has brought to my Lord to give to the young men who follow my Lord, please forgive the trespasses of your servant. That's a long, wordy apology. So let's break this down. Okay, apology starts here. On me alone, my Lord, be the guilt. She's becoming a substitute. She's willing to offer herself as punishment for someone that she already knows did evil and is worthless. She's willing to lay down her life for a sinner. Let not my Lord regard this worthless fellow. Look, I know that you know this guy did some bad things to you. But please, forget about it. Remember his sins no more. But I, your servant, did not see the young men of my Lord whom you sent. Look, I'm innocent. I'm an innocent person. I haven't done anything wrong in this situation. And I am willing, as an innocent person, willing to lay down my life so that you can forget the offense of this worthless man. Because the Lord has restrained you from blood guilt. It's the Lord who restrains. If we're left to our own devices, we will not restrain ourselves. And because the Lord has restrained you from saving with your own hands. David wanted to save with his own hands. He wanted to save himself. He wanted to take up the swords himself and save himself. But the way God works with grace, you cannot save yourself. And now, let your enemies and those who seek to do evil to my Lord be as Nabal fools. And now, let this present that your servant has brought to my Lord be given to the young men. So she's given a blessing to David. Does this sound familiar? Doesn't this paint a wonderful picture of Jesus? Jesus is an innocent man. He didn't do anything wrong. But he offered his life for you, even though he knows you're a sinner. But he's willing to do it to have God forget your sins so that you can be blessed. Isn't that crazy? Do you see how this woman was sensible? She understood the gospel better than we do. Now, for those of you who are super spiritual, I know there's a few of us, super spiritual people, very discerning. So they would say something like this. That was a bad apology. And I won't accept it. because I'm super spiritual and I'm very discerning. An apology should not include the word but. Because it shouldn't have any justifications. It should be an acknowledgement of wrongdoing. And this next line, I, your servant, did not see the young men of my Lord whom you sent. Who is she trying to blame there? She's not accepting responsibility on herself. Sounds like she's blaming David for even sending the people. And this, please forgive the trespasses of your servant. She just said she was innocent. Why would you ask for forgiveness if you're innocent? You know, innocent people don't do that. So how do you think David responded? Do you think he saw the grace in the situation? Or do you think he acted like a super spiritual, highly discerning person that has to have an apology that meets these seven different qualifications? If you guess he accepted her apology graciously, you're right. Because a person that accepts an apology gracefully is more like David and less like Nabal. And is more like Jesus and is more like God the Father than the super spiritual person. David gets it. And David said to Abigail, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, who sent you this day to meet me." So he realizes this is all of God. "Bless your discretion, and blessed be you who have kept me from this day of bloodshed and kept me from working salvation with my own hands." He gets that she was talking metaphorically about how salvation works, that salvation is by grace. You can't get it yourself. It has to be a work from God. "And surely as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, who has restrained me from hurting you, unless you had hurried and come to meet me, truly by morning there had not been left to Nabal as much as one male." Notice what he didn't say. He didn't say, "Oh, I need to follow my vow. My vow said I need to kill all these guys. You know, I can't break my word." He realized that he's wrong, and he realized, you know what? Grace can cover everything. Grace can cover your stupid promises that you make to God. Grace can cover your anger that you had. David wasn't man after God's own heart because he was a good guy. You get that? David wasn't the man after God's own heart because he was a good guy. He was a man after God's own heart because he understood that he wasn't the good guy, that he was required to depend on grace throughout everything. That is what makes David a man after God's own heart. Not verified righteousness, but a reliance on grace. And he accepts it. And then David received from her hand what she had brought. And he said to her, "Go up in peace to your house. See, I have obeyed your voice, and I have granted your petition." He received the gift from her. And because he received the gift from her, he understood that that brought peace. And it's the acceptance of grace that leads to obedience. It isn't obedience that leads to grace. "And obeyed your voice and have granted your petition. So I'm not gonna follow my vow I just made to killing all the guys. We're gonna turn around and we're gonna go back. And thank you for keeping me from being an absolute complete idiot." And Nabal went back to Nabal. And Abigail came to Nabal, and behold, he was holding a feast in his house, like the feast of a king. And Nabal's heart was merry within, for he was very drunk. So she told him nothing at all until the morning light. In the morning, when the wine had gone out of Nabal, his wife told him these things, and his heart died within him, and he became as a stone. Whenever she told him what happened, "Hey, took some stuff, offered this to David. David was going to kill you, but now he's not going to kill you because David's a man of grace." He was shocked. He was so shocked he had a stroke. And about 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal and he died. When Dave heard that Nabal was dead, he said, What do you think he said? Like, as an army chaplain, this is always, like, interesting how chaplains deal with this, because we're at a nation at war, and so we'll be praying for the guys that are the trigger pullers, that go out and pull the triggers, pray for their protection, pray for success, which means the enemy dies. And some chaplains really take this serious and, like, really pray for the enemy to die. And other chaplains are like, ooh, I'm super spiritual. I can't pray for people to die because it's not right, and maybe they should live to commit terrorist acts tomorrow or whatever. But David's real. What does he say? When David heard Nabal was dead, he said, "Blessed be the Lord." Isn't that astounding? Isn't that what you'd want to say? We're a lot like David in a lot of regards. We're stupid, unfocused, undisciplined. My only prayer is, I hope we understand grace. "Blessed be the Lord who avenged the insult I have received at the hand of Nabal and have kept back his servant from wrongdoing. The Lord has returned the evil of Nabal on his own head." Amazing stuff. Can't make this stuff up. Then David sent word to Abigail to take her as his wife. When the servants of David came to Abigail at Carmel, they said to her, "David has sent us to take you as his wife," and became his wife. Abigail rose, bowed with her face to the ground, and said, "Behold, your handmaiden is a servant or a slave to wash the feet of the servants of my lord David." And Abigail hurried, rose, mounted a donkey, and her five women attended her. She followed the messengers of David and became his wife. Now, here's a silly question. I understand why she became the wife of Nabal. Why'd she become the wife of David? That looks like a choice, doesn't it? Isn't that crazy? You can't make stuff up like this. Now, she might have been doing it because they just hit it off. You know, David, young, strappy, you know, going to be king, 20-year-old. I don't know how old she was. And maybe she was a gold digger. I don't know. Maybe she was just trying to stop a war between David's men and Nabal's men. No judgment here. But it doesn't end there. It gets crazier. David also took Anohim of Jezreel, and both of them, Abigail and Ahinoam, became his wives. So he got two wives. Imagine this wedding proposal. This is really good stuff for singles retreats, if you ever want to lead a singles retreat. Don't ask the girl to marry you. Just send your friends to go ask her for you. When she says yes, whenever she comes back, say, "Oh, I have a surprise. I'm getting married to two women." I mean, surely that would work. We should have a singles retreat based around that. That concept, it's biblical. Okay, and if that isn't bad enough, it gets worse, right? And Saul had given Michal, which is a girl, his daughter, to David because she was David's current wife. But Saul said, "No, you're not married to her anymore. You're not married to my daughter anymore. My daughter, Michal, is getting married to another guy, Palti." So she leaves David and marries Palti. Craziness. This guy would not be qualified to lead a small group. However, God chose this guy, to bring in a theocracy that Jesus is named after. This guy, David, his name is in the Bible more than Jesus. You ever think of that? Is that crazy? This guy. But he had this going for him. He understood grace. So who are you in this story? There's a connection card here. You're one of these people. I mean, this story sounds surreal, but yet so common. Who are you? Are you Samuel? Are you passing the baton to the next generation? Are you Nabal? Are you a fool, angry, selfish, concerned about stuff more than people, not generous? Or are you like Nabal's men? Just a group of passive-aggressive guys? Are you like Abigail? Wise, humble, servant, understand how true salvation works? Or are you like David? Young, dangerous, all over the map, unfocused, dependent on God's words and God's grace, not his own, relying on grace and not his own righteousness? Are you like David with a messed up home life, but still used by God, despite the mess? Or are you like David's men? I mean, think about what they just went through just in this chapter. David's like, hey, let's go to a funeral. And they're like, hey, let's go to a funeral. And then he's like, hey, we don't know this guy. Let's protect all his stuff. And they're like, yay, let's go protect all his stuff. And then he's like, hey, let's send him an invitation for us to come to his party. And they're like, yay, let's send an invitation for us to come to his party. And then he's like, let's kill him. And they're like, yay, let's kill him. And they're like, no. Let me complain for a while. And they're like, yay, complain for a while. And then he's like, well, I changed my mind. I'm not going to kill him. Yay, let's not kill him. Hey, let's get him a wife. Hey, let's go to a wedding. And another wedding at the same time. Yay, double the wedding. And they didn't complain or push back on his leadership at all. It's astounding. Don't you wish you could follow Jesus the same way that David's men followed him? I mean, most of us, if not all of us, push back on Jesus. Then David's men push back on David. Maybe we should all want to be like David's men. Or are we like Enoam? She's mentioned in the story. Yeah, David married this other one. But she really doesn't play a part. Do you feel that way? Do you feel like you're present? Part of the story? But you'd rather play an insignificant role and aren't really a part? Enoam goes on to give David his first son. She does some great and wonderful things, starting from this point here. Even though she played an insignificant role here, just because you are playing an insignificant role now doesn't mean that you're going to be playing an insignificant role forever. God's grace can come into that situation and build you, giving you more and more significance as you rely on him. Or are you like Michael, that poor woman, used by her family for ulterior purposes, given to a guy, taken away from that guy, given to another guy, taken away from that guy, given back to David? I mean, there are some of us who are used and abused by our parents. There are some of us who are parents that are used and abused by their kids. God can come into all of these situations. God can show grace in all of these situations. Enoam was mentioned second here. That was the only time she was mentioned second. All the other times, it was Winnowin and Abigail. Her name came first. Who are you? Who are you in this story? Who are you in this picture? God was present in each and every one of these lives. And God can be present in each and every one of our lives. Here we go in the story.